Video and computer games have become so commonplace in our society, it's hard to imagine a world without them. In this month's episode of History Explorer, we'll be hearing from Petrina Foti, a curator at the National Museum of American History who has studied the history of video and computer games. Within the museum's collection are the papers and objects that Ralph Baer, creator of the first home video game system, used to develop his inventions. Petrina talks about Baer's Brown Box, the prototype for the Magnavox Odyssey, which hit stores in 1972. A precursor to Pong, Atari, Nintendo, and all the rest, Baer's system was truly innovative for its time. Petrina will also cover what sort of questions and research went into studying objects such as the video game collection, and how a single object can be interpreted in multiple ways.
I'm Petrina Foti. I've been with the museum since 2006. I have worked in a couple different offices in the museum, but the longest has been in the computers collection, which I worked for 4 years. I have just recently moved to the division of home and community life. And just to begin about the history of video games, it sort of starts with Ralph Baer. And if you don't know who Ralph Baer is, he's considered to be the father of the video game. He was a German Jew whose family escaped right before Kristallnacht. His family was really lucky that they had already family living in the United States. So they were able to come here. He was a young man at the time, just a teenager. And the first thing he did is he got his radio engineer license. And just as he was trying to figure out what's next, he got drafted into the Army, served in World War II. Afterwards, on the GI Bill, he went back and he got his television engineering degree, an actual degree in television engineering. Televisions were a new product and very complicated back then. He had a long career as an engineer, and then in the late 1960s, he's working for an engineering company called Sanders. And even though this had nothing to do with television, he happened to be thinking about TVs and came up with the idea of video games. This was in the 60s. And the next day, he went to work and he sat down and he wrote out a 4-page memo detailing the idea and as many ways it could be applied as possible. And he and a colleague put together the first test unit, TV Game Unit 1. And it was vacuum tubes and transistors, and it was just a put-together test unit that was meant to say, okay, look, we can, in fact, move a dot on the screen, and that's all it did. They weren't trying to reinvent the technology at this point. They just used what they knew was going to work. And once they proved that, yes, we can do it, then they went back, and Ralph Baer assembled a team of two guys, Bill Harrison and Bill Rausch, and then they started progressively complicated TV game units. The result was the Brown Box, which was about TV game unit 7. And the Brown Box looks a lot like what you see today. It console, two controllers. You could play multiple games by depending on where you put the switches. And the switches, you use these index cards that had little dots on them. So that's how you knew which switches needed to be up and which ones needed to be down. And when you look at them, you're like, ooh, the very first video games. That prototype was then licensed to Magnavox, which released the Brown Box as the Magnavox Odyssey. In 1972. And normally when people think about the first video game, they immediately say Pong. Noel Bushnell and Atari, and that's who they think of. In fact, Odyssey beat Pong to the market by a few months. Pong debuted in 1972 as well. But Odyssey came out first. And in fact, Noel Bushnell had seen Odyssey being demoed at a trade show and thought, hey, this makes a really great arcade game. Odyssey, for a variety of reasons, was not as successful as you might have expected it to be. However, Pong was this runaway success. But it was only when it tried to enter the home, Atari made a deal with Sears to release these home versions of Pong. And then suddenly, Megan said, Fox said, no, we have the license. So it was the start of a series of court cases.
Now, when you first kind of met this collection and were introduced to it, can you describe that and how you started forming your research and started looking at these objects?
Yeah. I probably should bring up the fact that I had no basis in computer history or computers at all. I was the classic person who would smack my monitor and think that would actually do something to fix my computer. But I was a librarian, so I had this librarian brain that could sort and organize things. And David Allison hired me anyways. His response was, when I admitted no background in computer history, said, it's okay, you'll learn. But fortunately, the first objects that I had to work with or accession were Ralph Baer's, and I knew something about video game history already. I had lived a lot of it, so I had played the NES, so it didn't take a lot of extra work for me to play catch up. So the very first time, my very first project, is I got brought into the storage area, and the storage area is filled with these boxes that the papers and the video cassettes and the actual prototypes are in. So the first thing I had to do was open up the boxes and take everything out and check them off against the list. And here, I've worked in a library for 4 or 5 years at this point, and so I was used to doing stuff like that, opening boxes, check the purchase order. Did this come in? Does this come in? And so that's what I was doing. And the first thing that I realized, I said, we got things on this list that aren't on the, we got things that aren't on the list, and there's stuff that didn't come. And David just laughed and he said, well, welcome to museum work. It's not always so straightforward. But that was the first thing. And then we did some background research just by listening to Ralph Baer talk or doing some of the books, and did some basic research to just catalog them to understand what object was which. And Ralph Baer had written a book about, and he talks about each of the objects, and that was invaluable. And just reading what he was talking about and then looking and saying, okay, so this is this object. This is what this was used for, and this is how it was used. A few years later, I was preparing a web group, which requires a lot more writing and a lot more research. So yes, I turned to Ralph Baer's book. I also went down to the Archive Center because they conducted an oral history with him. So I listened to all that oral history and I took plenty of notes. And then I started consulting secondary sources, because it's one thing to talk about the objects for your own purposes, to understand what they are from the inventor. But then you have to have a broader context. You have to read what other people were saying about it. And there are some books devoted to video game history. Not many, not a lot to choose from. And each of them have their own flaws. But a lot of them, probably based on their own interviews from the early days, were pretty consistent. So I could check those outside sources and just listen to what other people's perspectives on this early story was.
Now, when it came to these video game objects, which specific sources do you think yielded the best data?
It's not like I had a lot to choose from. For early video game history, obviously, Ralph Baer's book, anything that Ralph Baer wrote or conducted was extremely helpful. The flip side of it, of course, of his book, was that he was an engineer. So when he's talking about these objects, he's using specific language and he's getting into details that maybe the layperson doesn't necessarily understand or even needs to know. So there was this bit of reading it, then having to absorb it. Sometimes I'd be reading whole passages two or three times just to make sure I really was understanding what he was saying. And then I had to turn around and be able to not only just understand it, but then I had to be able to explain it to another audience who does not come from an engineering background. I found a lot of times when I was writing about computer history, I was very aware of there's a dual audience almost. There's the general public who may not have a lot of background knowledge about this. And so you have to get that level right. But then you also have to make sure that it's technically right. Even if you're talking very general, in general terms, you have to make sure you're using the right language, because there's a whole community out there of people who do understand computers, who do understand the technical side of things. And if you're too general and you're just to the point that you've lost actually what had happened, not to get off the topic of video games, but a good example is I wrote a blog post about Y2K. Mm-hmm. Explaining Y2K gets really, really complicated, just because it gets into program languages and things like that. But so how do you explain it in a way that's not confusing, that really gets into the heart of what it does? And in the end, you just have to say, well, really, the problem is that 00 does not consecutively follow 99. And that's the root of the problem, which people who don't understand computers would understand that, mm-hmm. grasp that. People who do understand computers would say, yes, that's true, but, and then you say, yes, I understand the but.
So creating this historical interpretation is really striking a balance that the entire audience is going to be able
right.
to comprehend.
You have to be able to make sure that you are correct, that you haven't gone so into the general that you aren't saying anything at all. But at the same time, you can't go so deeply into the specific that you lose the main part of your audience.
So how do you feel the story of Ralph Baer and the video game fit into maybe a larger context of American history?
I think there's a lot of different ways it fits in, and it also depends on who you're asking.
Right.
obviously, if you talk to the Lemelson Center, the first thing they'll say is, invention, it fits in the story of invention. If you talk to somebody, say, in art and culture, urban community life, they might say, well, it shapes the everyday life. It shapes our popular culture. It's how people entertain themselves. And then from a technical standpoint, it changes the way that people approach computers. One of the first things people did was play games. You know, when the PC came out and it was reaching, people used it for specific purposes, for accounting practices and things like that. But before you knew it, they were playing games.
Right.
And think about your own memories. I mean, when we got our first computer, Mom said, okay, now you can, like, write your papers and things like that. What did we do? We were all playing games.
It's a game machine.
It was. Even the math programs that my brothers were supposed to use, they were games.
Yeah, learning how to type and things like that.
Yeah, they were all games. In the forms of games. So games became an education tool, which they're still being talked at. Video games are still being referred to as education tools. But even from the very beginning, I think that was their contribution.
So it sounds like, as with a lot of objects, there's a lot of different stories that can be told from one single object. Here.
Right.
Yeah.
You can, when I was in graduate school, we had this one assignment, take an object and describe it as many ways from as many different perspectives as possible. And just the brown box. I chose the brown box because I was working here at the time as well. And, you know, I took it from, you could take it from a invention standpoint. You could take it from a history standpoint. You could take it from a pastime standpoint. you could even, I've heard people in this museum go on about the fact that Ralph Baer chose to cover the brown box in wood grain vinyl, fake wood grain. And what does that mean? And what does it mean to be that they're trying to make something high tech look like natural? So I've seen it being interpreted in many different ways.
Thanks to Petrina Foti for taking the time to speak with us. For the History Explorer podcast, this is Matt Ringelsteiner. Join us again next month as we take another look at what goes on behind the scenes here at the National Museum of American History. Music by Tu Pol. Hear more on freemusicarchive.org. Podcast made possible by a grant from the Verizon Foundation.